Once again, my head hurts from going over all this apologetic stuff. And I didn't print up any notes because we're just going to zip right through a lot of stuff. I don't want you to be at all deceived. This is not my original material. I'm sharing what was given to us as course material, and I'm just kind of picking out the things that I think are going to be most meaningful and that I can relate as best as I can. But let's begin with a couple of scriptures. Just to kind of set the mood and get our minds thinking the right way, we're going to look at Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. I'll give you a moment to get there. And this is just good stuff, no matter what you're studying or what you're thinking or what you're going through. Isaiah 55, and then we're going to go to Isaiah 40, verses 25 through 26. And Isaiah 55, verse 8, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." As the psalmist often says, Selah. Think about that. Take a moment to pause and think about that. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. And then our next scripture in Isaiah 40, verses 25 and 26. "To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One?" As we go on with this evening's lesson, we're kind of looking at faith in science. There was a much more elaborate title that they had for this lesson, but really, that's what it boils down to. Faith and science, how those two go together or not. One of the legacies of the so-called Enlightenment is the conviction that reason has triumphed over faith, that scientific progress has rendered religion obsolete. Mm-hmm. And that's something we really battle with on a daily basis. Our influences in media, in just our culture wants to continually push God aside and say, faith is not relevant. Your belief in a higher power is not really important anymore. We have overcome that. We have gone beyond it. Commenting on whether science should do away with religion, Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg said this: "The world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done and may, in fact, be our greatest contribution to civilization." Think about that. Richard Dawkins, we've all heard of him. He says, "I'm utterly fed up with the respect that we have been brainwashed into bestowing upon religion." And Dawkins quotes a guy by the name of Robert Persig, who said, "When one person suffers from a delusion, it's called insanity. When many people suffer from a delusion, it's called religion." That's the growing thought out there, a worldview that is taking over. And we've got to know how to respond. We've got to know where we stand and why we stand where we stand. Not merely taking a position, but having an understanding of why that position is valid. Another guy, Douglas Adams, says, "It isn't enough to say that a garden is beautiful without having to believe, or isn't it?" He says, "Isn't it enough to say that a garden is beautiful without having to believe there are fairies at the bottom of it?" And if you think about it, that is exposing the fallacy of this whole mindset. That quote is flawed in its thinking. It suggests that there are either fairies or nothing. You have to make that choice. Fairies are delusional, of course. But what about a gardener? What if we saw a garden and we attributed that to the gardener or even the owner of that property? You see, there's more than just that one simple choice. The notion that faith isn't based on empirical scientific evidence is the principal vice of religion. In fact, these folks believe that faith is simply pulled out of thin air without the slightest bit of evidence. I don't know. How do you feel about that? Dawkins likes to make a distinction between faith and science, stating that science is based on a publicly checkable evidence. Faith, however, he says, rejoices in the lack of evidence. Do we? You know, sometimes people make assumptions or make statements about people of faith, and I wonder, who are they hanging out with? Where are they getting these crazy ideas? What kind of people are they finding somewhere out in the woods or wherever, and they're coming up with this strange thinking? Dawkins has obviously never tried to seek any evidence. If he did, he would find out that our faith really is a commitment based on evidence. And in fact, at the time, much of it was publicly checkable evidence. We talked about some of this last week. In Luke, his gospel, he set out to document the truth as things happened from the very beginning, he says. And he spoke to eyewitnesses, and he was creating this letter for an educated reader, the Roman Theophilus, so that he might certainly understand the things that happened and that they were true. John, we also talked about last week, presented evidence upon which others could make a solid decision. He wanted them to know the truth so that they could decide for themselves to believe on Jesus and to be saved in his name. From Luke and John and the rest of the disciples, they all had hard evidence. They had hard evidence in which to make their decision. In fact, it was necessary for them to have that evidence to distinguish it from fairy tales, from fantasy. And yet still the myth persists that Christian faith is blind faith. And that's what I used to think too, as an atheist, because I never really checked out the evidence. I never looked into whether or not there was something substantial behind the claims of Christianity. Science, though, it has its limits. See, another myth that is promoted by the likes of Peter Atkins, an Oxford chemist. He says, science and religion cannot be reconciled. If that were so, then all serious scientists would be atheists, wouldn't they? But that's not the case. That's not the case. As an example, take the Human Genome Project. Its first director was a Nobel Prize winner. His name was James Watson. He was a committed atheist. The man who took over, Francis Collins, was also a committed Christian. So in this one highly publicized project, you have two top scientists with totally different perspectives. How could he be a Christian and yet be a scientist? Christians claim there is a God who created and upholds the universe by his power. And we believe the universe bears influence of that. Right? We've been talking about Romans 1:20, where Paul says, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, creation, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. In other words, there is evidence in nature alone. So let's consider some evidence. The conviction that the universe is ordered is at the very core of scientific endeavor. But now, where did that conviction come from? If they believe that the universe is ordered, a guy by the name, a Nobel Prize winner, by the way, in biochemistry, I've got a lot of quotes tonight, so hopefully you're not trying to write all of these down. Melvin Calvin, he says this, as I try to discern the origin of that conviction, I seem to find in it a basic notion discovered 2,000 or 3,000 years ago and enunciated first in the Western world by the ancient Hebrews, namely that the universe is governed by a single God and is not the product of the whim of many gods, each governing his own province according to his own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation for modern science. See, all of science is based on there being predictability. It's based on there being an order, something that they can compare one set of instruments or a set of statistics with another, one set of outcomes with another. C.S. Lewis said it rather distinctly. He said, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. The great pioneers of science, Galileo, Kepler, Pascal, Boyle, Newton, Faraday, Babbage, all of them were theists. Most of them were Christian. They all believed in a creator. Their belief in God wasn't a hindrance to their science. In fact, in most cases, it was sheer inspiration to their science. Galileo's treatment at the hands of the Roman Catholic Church is often used as fuel in this concept that there is a conflict between science and religion that cannot be satisfied. But we want to look at that a little closer. Galileo was no atheist. Galileo was a believer in the scriptures. And at the hands of the Roman Catholic Church, he was charged with a crime that challenged the reigning scientific paradigm of the aristocrats of that day. And that was that a fixed and unmoving earth was the center of the universe. But he wasn't coming at it from the standpoint of a non-believer trying to convince a believing, or shall I say, a faith world. He was approaching it as a believer and recognizing the work that God had already established. Galileo was a believer in the scriptures before his discoveries and before the controversy, and he was a believer in the scriptures afterward. It didn't change. It was a view held, this world is flat kind of idea was held not only by the church, but it was also held by the pagan philosophers of that day, of those who had no faith in a monotheistic God. So it's kind of ironic and it's remarkable that this believer in the scriptures challenging the reigning belief of the day, that he was actually doing it in the name of science. So science and faith, science and religion, are compatible, can be compatible. When we're looking at this science and religion thing, one of the things we need to ask ourselves, is there a limit to science? Because many believe that science holds the answers to all things. This Peter Atkins says, there is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. That fundamental belief is what we call scientism. If it were true, well, it would spell the end of many academic disciplines like philosophy and ethics, literature, poetry, music. Where would they be if science had the answer to every aspect of existence. How could science tell us whether a poem was a bad poem or a work of genius? How could science tell us what makes a good song and what doesn't? How can science help us understand emotions and the inner feelings of the human existence? Science has its limits. And that's not an insult to science to say so. It's just the reality. When you're talking about science, well, what about morality? What about ethics? Science can tell you, if you were to put arsenic in your Aunt Mabel's tea, that it would surely kill her in sufficient amounts. But it can't tell you if it's morally right to do so or not in order to gain an early inheritance, can it? Science has its limits. Sir Peter Medawar said this: "The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike, elementary questions having to do with first and last things. How did everything begin? What is the point of living? What are we here for?" He goes on. "It is to imaginative literature and religion that we must turn for answers to such questions." Let me give you an example. Let's say, Kurt bakes a cake.
He did cookies.
Well, let's say he baked a cake. We could take that cake and we could set it before a panel of distinguished scientists, the best in the world, and they could examine that cake. They would tear it apart. They would examine every aspect of it. They could tell you all of the ingredients in it. They could tell you how it was made. They could tell you temperatures involved in the process. They could deduce a whole lot of information, even down to the molecular structure of that cake. What they can't tell you is, why did he make it? Well, you might guess that, but maybe that isn't why you made it. Why did you make it? Was there a birthday involved? Some other celebration? Was it just a cool day and you thought if I used the oven, it would warm the house a little? Science isn't going to tell you that. Science has its limits. Why was it made? See, science can cope with questions about the structure and the nature of the cake, but it cannot answer questions about ultimate purpose. In order to know ultimate purpose, you have to go and ask the Creator. Here's what's important. If Kurt can tell us why he baked the cake, that doesn't mean that reason is either inactive or irrelevant. Because they want us to be reasonable. Well, just because we are looking for answers directly from Kurt instead of from all of the ingredients that he put together in this cake, it doesn't mean that we've become unreasonable. No, it's clearly reasonable to ask. Reason is still essential to both understand and assess the credibility of his explanation about why he made the cake. Our ability to reason cannot create that information, but it's absolutely essential to be able to process it, to really understand the cake. Francis Bacon often talked about God's two books, the book of nature and the Holy Bible, looking at both the natural side and the spiritual side. Many in science have a flawed pattern of thinking. They believe that if they can explain something, then, well, it precludes the idea of a creator. If they can explain how a plant grows, well, then there is no creator involved. Think about that from a different perspective. Let's say we were looking at a Ford Model A vehicle. We were going to examine the prototype of Ford's best-selling car back in the old days. Well, you could sit down and you could tear it apart. You could take all of the pieces apart. You could even understand some about the internal combustion engine and all sorts of things that you could derive from that examination. Just because we understand how the internal combustion engine works and all of the other parts that were involved in the manufacture of that vehicle does not mean it is void of a creator. There was a creator behind it. Just because we can understand it and we can explain it doesn't mean there's not a creator involved. And science has a way of reducing everything. We call it reductionism. All of science kind of lies in the conviction that the universe can be understood at least in part, and they break it down to its simplest part. Is that possible? Albert Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible, that there are parts about the universe you can understand. Nobel laureate in physics, Eugene Wigner, he said the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there is no rational explanation for it. It is an article of faith. See, science itself cannot account for this phenomenon, that we can actually explain things about science, about the world we live in, about the universe that surrounds us. Why is that so? How is it that they can't account for that? Because to do so, you must believe that the universe is rationally intelligible. You must believe that there is a reason behind it all. See if I can get this name right, Polkinghorne said this. He said, science does not explain the mathematical intelligibility of the physical world because it is part of science's founding faith that it is so. They just believe. It's all mathematically intelligible. And here are two of the world's most eminent scientists telling us that faith plays a foundational role in science. Faith is inseparable from the scientific endeavor. There has to be that understanding. Keith Ward of Oxford, he said this, to the majority of those who've reflected deeply and written about the origin and nature of the universe, it is seen that it points beyond itself to a source which is non-physical and of great intelligence and power. Almost the entire great classical philosophers, certainly Plato, Aristotle, and so on, saw the origin of the universe as lying in a transcendent reality. They had different specific ideas about this reality and different ways of approaching it. But the universe is not self-explanatory, and that it requires some explanation beyond itself was something that they all accepted as fairly obvious. A lot of words. But he's saying there are things they can't explain. And there are things that you, even as a scientist, have to take on faith. The rational explanation is that the intelligibility of the universe is grounded in the intelligence of God. God who created both the universe and the human mind. If you, if you got into, I just would love to be in a room where you have these very intelligent scientists on both sides and just listen to them banter back and forth about this. The more you hear of the atheistic side of science as opposed to the creation, intelligent design side of science, the more the atheistic side just sounds like, are you kidding? Get real. How can that be? Christians sometimes, you know, we hitch our wagons too closely to a particular scientific star, and then when science advances, we're kind of left out in the cold. It'd be wiser for us to talk about convergences between our current understanding of Scripture and of science that will allow for us to see each one of them informing the other. For centuries, Aristotle's view of an eternal universe was the predominant thought. And now most scientists believe that the universe had a beginning. When that idea first started to emerge, some scientists resisted it fiercely. But it's now become the commonplace thought that the universe had a beginning. Arno Penzias, who was awarded a Nobel Prize for discovering the microwave background, makes precisely this point. He says, the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. Science has shown that many of the fundamental constants of nature, from the energy levels of the carbon atom to the rate at which the universe is expanding, have just the right values for life to exist. That change any of those values in the slightest amount, and everything falls apart. Our universe has the kind of accuracy a marksman would need to hit a coin on the far side of the observable universe, 20 billion light years away. It's remarkable. Edward Harrison said, take your choice, blind chance that requires multitudes of universes or design that requires only one. Many scientists, when they admit their views, incline toward the theological or design argument. And here we've always been led to believe that science is opposed to faith, that science is opposed to scriptural truth. That's not it. Let's consider the biology side of this. Richard Dawkins, he's a biologist, an evolutionary biologist, and that's usually where we do most of our battle in this realm, with evolution, right?
Right.
Dawkins offers us a straight choice. He defines biology to be the study of complicated things which give the impression of having been created for a purpose. Now, think about that. It's complicated things that give the impression of having been created for a purpose. Well, if it looks like a duck, and it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, why don't we just call it a duck? See, he gives you that choice. It's either God or evolution. He can't seem to bring the two together. To him, evolution leaves no alternative than atheism. And he chooses to believe evolution. He believes biological evolution is incompatible with the existence of a creator, and biological evolution accounts for the existence and purposeful form of all life. How can you come to that conclusion? I do not understand. Truth of the matter is, many scientists believe in God as well as in evolution. I'm not there. But a lot of scientists are. Questions are being asked, and not just by religion, not just by believers in God. They're asking whether evolution can bear all of the weight that's been put upon it. You know, some believe evolution is merely a biological mechanism, and that God is the one who created evolution. Kind of like Henry Ford created his car. And that car had a purpose. He designed it for a reason. It was a machine that would do something that needed to be done. Some scientists believe that's what evolution is. It's a creation of God. It's his mechanism for doing what he wanted to do in the world. Again, I'm not there. A guy by the name of Sir John Houghton said, "The fact that we understand some of the mechanisms of the working of the universe or of living systems does not preclude the existence of a designer any more than possession of insight into the processes by which a watch has been put together, however automatic these processes may appear, implies that there is no watchmaker." So to some, the evolutionary viewpoint doesn't invalidate the inference of intelligent design. Instead, it moves it down one level. Instead of evolution being the primary cause, it's the secondary cause. God being the primary cause who established evolution. Some sort of evolution is a logical necessity for the materialist or the naturalist. I mean, if all we have is matter and energy and the forces of physics and time, there's only one logical option. These forces over time have produced life. Has produced it unaided by anything else. But can the evolutionary mechanism bear all of that weight on its own? I don't think so. Kurt Gödel said the complexity of living bodies has to be present in the material or in the laws. In particular, the materials forming the organs, if they are governed by mechanical laws, have to be of the same order of complexity as the living body. It is, if you can, it's one of those, what? The complexity of living bodies has to be present in the material or in the laws, in particular, the materials forming the organs, if they are governed by mechanical laws, have to be of the same order of complexity as the living body. Stephen Meyer said, "Self-organizational theorists explain well what does not need to be explained. What needs explaining is not the origin of order, but the origin of information." See, it's one thing to have something ordered, but you have to ask yourself, why is it ordered? How did it become ordered? Who provided the information as to what order was? The existence of complex specified information, therefore, provides a very substantial challenge to the notion that unguided natural processes can account for life. That all on its own, these inanimate objects could somehow come together and produce life. It just doesn't make scientific sense if you understand science. The suggestion that an intelligent source was responsible is obvious. It's a frequent objection that the design inference, in other words, that we believe there was a creator that designed this, that it comes from ignorance, that it's being used to cover up a gap. The gap in our present state of scientific knowledge. In other words, rather than getting hard scientific facts, we just make up a story. We try and come up with some other idea to explain it, rather than working harder and finding the information through science. For us believers, of course, the main thrust of the design argument is from what we know, not from what we don't know. We've come to this conclusion by what's been revealed to us through the scriptures and through nature. It's not just we're making up this story. We're just coming up with some other idea. when it comes to fully explaining writing on paper. How would you do that? Again, you could have paper and ink analyzed, and they could tell you an awful lot. They might even be able to tell you what instrument was used to create the writing. But how do you explain writing on paper simply by the power of physics and chemistry? It does not compute. The crux of the matter is science prepared to follow where the evidence leads? You see, for us, it's easy to see. We come from a different worldview. And for many scientists, they also come from that worldview. And I guess I want to make sure I emphasize that enough. Not all scientists are atheists. In fact, a majority of scientists are believers in God. But that's not who you hear from the most, because that's not the controversy that gets put before us. Will science follow the evidence where it leads, even if it points against its naturalistic explanations? For scientists like Peter Atkins and Richard Dawkins to say that God is an explanation of anything at any level, that it's just to fill in the gaps that we don't know, it's just not complex enough for them. Well, God is, by definition, more complicated than anything they've ever tried to explain. And that, again, that's part of the problem. Scientists believe that you have to explain the more complex in terms that are less complex. Remember, I said they like to break the complex down into its finest part and then put those parts back together to explain how everything works, how everything functions. But simplicity is not the only criterion of truth. It's not to be wondered that something that is more complex can always be explained by something less complex. If, let's say, we were hanging out with an archaeologist and we started to explore some caves, and in that cave, we're just walking along and there are some marks on the wall, and I just move ahead, and that archaeologist stops and says, "Hey, wait, this is a sign of human life." And I look at it, and it's like just a couple scratches on the wall. How can you be so sure this is signs of human life? Well, through their studies, they've come to understand that the language in that particular region or whatever, that was a symbol that indicated life. To me, it's nothing more than a couple of scratches on the wall. To them, they can see much deeper into this issue than I can. When we're faced with just a few scratches on the wall, scientists have no problem believing that there is intelligent life behind it. And yet, when faced with something like DNA, all right, where if you break it down, I mean, they've gotten to the point where they believe that there's like 3.5 billion letter sequences of the human genome, 3.5 billion. And yet they believe that it is solely because of chance that it's that way. I don't know. Hurts my head to try and think of how they think. It's like, wait, how do you come? All right. Let me give it to you simple. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. All things were made by Him. It's that easy. mass energy belongs to the category of the created. The Word does not. The contrast of the two worldviews is shown here. One says that matter and energy are primary and that information is ultimately derivative. The other idea, well, it all comes from God. That it's God who established mass and energy and the rest of creation. At the heart of the biblical analysis of all of the creative acts, we find the very concept that science in recent times has also shown to be of paramount importance, the existence of information. To them, it's all information-based, right? This key notion that the Creator is God, the Word, is reflected in the repeated phrase, "And God said," in the creation narrative in Genesis. "And God said," God the Word, who is a person, became human to demonstrate fully that the ultimate truth behind the universe is not a theory, it's not a philosophy, but in fact it is a person. It is a person. Jesus Christ. Science is not willing to accept that. Once again, John 1:14, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." All of science, and even those not involved in science, have to begin with one of two precepts. Either human intelligence ultimately owes its origin to a mindless master, or there is a creator. And as I said Sunday, I don't know how you look at a baby and think it's just a matter of chance. All of these things come together the way they do. You know, I've in my days, not recently, but in my past, I raised chickens. And I would get the egg, put it in an incubator, wait 21 days, and out pops a live chicken. How does that happen? By chance. How does all of the stuff, that goop inside the shell, with a little bit of warmth, the right humidity, turn to life and grow into a chicken that somehow knows at the right time to peck its way out of the shell? Is this by chance? And then, of course, you get into the chicken or the egg. How did this... You know, when they tell you through evolution that things just kind of slowly changed from one thing into many different, and it's like, well, I can't make that work in my brain. I accepted it before I really thought about it. Back in my high school days, they told me, oh, yeah, this evolution, that's the thing. Oh, okay. But if you really stop and think about it, and, you know, I do a lot of photography, and I do a lot of nature and bugs and trees and all kinds of nature. And you look at stuff and you go, how can you not see intelligent design here? How can you not see the difference between this bird and that bird and that dog and this grass, and not see that there is a master plan behind it? It's not just a matter of chance. I can't even make that work with billions and billions of years to try and fix that. It just does not compute in my brain. And I'm continually marveling at the wonderful work of God, at just the amazing diversity that we have. And I believe in, you know, aspects of natural change, natural selection, those kind of things. I don't deny that. But when you get down to the basic, how did life begin and how are we who we are as a human race, as opposed to any other creature on the earth? The differences that there are between human beings and animals. You know, it's kind of scary how some people don't really see that difference. Some people want to equate animals with human beings. That's kind of scary. It is to me. There are distinct differences. You are created in His image. You do have unique qualities that no other animal in this universe or any universe can exhibit and enjoy. So science, I believe, as they continue with their process, are going to grow closer and closer to revealing the truth about God as the Creator, and that faith isn't just foolishness. You know, we're not just all, you know, dippy dunces. We're people who have minds. You know, I often told people who say, well, how can you believe all of that? Well, I didn't leave my brain at the door when I went into church. Yeah. There is reason that coincides with science. It all depends much upon your worldview. If you want to approach it from an inanimate bunch of stuff just got together and made all that we can see around us, well, you're not going to approach it from my same worldview. Amen? Well, I hope it helped you a little bit. And if nothing else, you should be more confident in what you believe, having a purpose, having a foundation that you're not supported with in much of the scientific community that we hear of. Believe me, there are many, many scientists who are believers, and many scientists who look for God in the things that they're doing. They see by the evidence that they are finding more and more reality of a Creator. All right, I'll just ramble on or I'll quit. So I'll quit. Thank you for coming. I'm not the same.